weeping eyes. Glockter could go no further. He stood there, leaning on his cane, fighting with every ounce of will against the need to fall to his knees, turn and crawl away. Nine Fingers was faring little better, breathing hard through his nose, a look of the most profound horror and disgust on his face. Luthar was in considerably worse shape, teeth gritted, white-faced and palsied. He dropped slowly down on one knee, gasping, as Glockter edged past him. Baez did not seem afraid. He stepped right up to the door and ran his fingers over the larger symbols. 11 wards and 11 wards reversed. He traced the circle of smaller characters. And 11 times 11. His finger followed the fine line outside them. Can it be that line is made of tiny letters, too? Who can say how many hundreds here? Truly, a most potent enchantment. The sense of awe was only slightly diminished by the sound of Luthar puking noisily over the side of the bridge.
What does it say?
Croaked Glockter, swallowing some bile of his own. The old man grinned at him. Can you not feel it, Inquisitor? It says, turn away. It says, get you gone. It says, none shall pass. But the message is not for us. He reached into his collar and pulled out the rod of metal, the same dark metal as the door itself.
We shouldn't be here, growled Nine Fingers from behind. This place is dead. We should go.
But Baez did not seem to hear. The magic has leaked out of the world, Glockter heard him murmuring, and all the achievements of Juvens lie in ruins. He weighed the key in his hand, brought it slowly upwards. But the Maker's works stand strong as ever. Time has not diminished them, nor ever will. There did not even seem to be a hole, but the key slid slowly into the door. Slowly, slowly, into the very centre of the circles. Glockter held his breath. Click. And nothing happened. The door did not open. That is all, then. The game is over. He felt a surge of relief as he turned back towards the Agriant, raising a hand to signal to the practicals on the wall above. I need not go further. I need not. Then an answering echo came from deep within. Click. Glockter felt his face twitch in sympathy with the sound. Did I imagine it? He hoped so with all his being. Click. Again. No mistake. And now, before his disbelieving eyes, the circles in the door began to turn. Glockter took a stunned step back, his cane scraping on the stones of the bridge. Click. Click. There had been no sign that the metal was not all one piece. No cracks, no grooves, no mechanism. And yet, the circles span, each at a different speed. Click, click, click. Faster now, and faster. Glockter felt dizzy. The innermost ring with the largest letters was still crawling. The outermost, the thinnest one, was flying round too fast for his eyes to follow. Click, 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 click. Shapes formed in the markings as the symbols passed each other. Lines, squares, triangles, unimaginably intricate, dancing before his eyes, then vanishing as the wheels spun on. Click. And the circles were still, arranged in a new pattern. Baez reached up and pulled the key from the door. There was a soft hissing, barely audible, as of water far away, and a long crack appeared in the door. The two halves moved slowly, smoothly away from each other. The space between them grew steadily larger. Click. They slid into the walls, flush with the sides of the square archway. The door stood open. Now that, said Baez softly, is craftsmanship. No fetid wind spilled out. No stench of rot or decay, no sign of long years past, only a waft of cool, dry air. and yet the feeling is of opening a coffin. Silence, but for the wind fumbling across the dark stones, the breath sighing in Glockta's dry throat, the distant lapping of the water far below. The unearthly terror was gone. He felt only a deep worry as he stared into the open archway. But no worse than when I wait outside the Archlector's office. Baez turned round, smiling.
Long years have passed since I sealed this place, and in all that slow time no man has crossed the threshold. You three are truly honored.
Glockta did not feel honored. He felt ill.
There are dangers within. Touch nothing, and go only where I lead you. Follow close behind me, for the ways are not always the same.
Not the same? Asked Glockta. How can that be? The old man shrugged.
I am only the doorman, he said, as he slipped the key and its chain back inside his shirt. Not the architect.
And he stepped into the shadows. Giselle did not feel well, not well at all. It was not simply the vile nausea that the letters on the doors had somehow created. It was more, a lurch of sudden shock and disgust, like picking up a cup and drinking, expecting water, and finding something else inside. Piss, perhaps, in this case. That same wave of ugly surprise, but stretching out over minutes, over hours. Things that he had dismissed as foolishness or old stories were suddenly revealed as facts before his eyes. The world was a different place than it had been the day before. A weird and unsettling place, and he had infinitely preferred it the way it was. He could not understand why he had to be here. Giselle knew precious little about history. Canadius, Juvens, Baez even. They were names from dusty books, heard as a child and holding no interest even then. It was just bad luck. Bad luck was all. He had won the contest, and here he was, wandering about in some strange old tower. That was all it was, a strange old tower.
Welcome, said Baez. To the house of the Maker.
Giselle looked up from the floor, and his jaw sagged open. The word house did little to describe the vastness of the dim space in which he found himself. The Lord's Round itself could have fitted comfortably inside it, the entire building, with room to spare. The walls were made from rough stones, unfinished, unmortared, piled haphazardly, but rising endlessly upward. Upward. Above the center of the room, far above, something was suspended. A huge, fascinating something. It put Giselle in mind of a navigator's instruments, rendered on an enormous scale. A system of gigantic metal rings, shining in the dim light, one about the other, with further smaller rings running between them, inside them, around them. Hundreds of them, perhaps, all told, scored with markings. Writing, maybe, or meaningless scratches. A large black ball hung in the center. Baez was already walking out into the vast circle of the floor, covered in intricate lines, set into the dark stone in bright metal, his footfalls echoing high above. Giselle crept after him. There was something frightening, something dizzying about moving across a space so huge.
This is Middleland, said Baez.
What?
The old man pointed down. The squiggly lines of metal began to take on meaning. Coastlines, mountains, rivers, the land and the sea. The shape of Middleland, clear in Giselle's mind from 100 maps, was laid out beneath his feet.
The whole circle of the world.
Baez gestured across the endless floor.
That way is Angland, and beyond, the north. Gurkul is over there. There is Starikland, and the old empire, and over here, the city-states of Styria. Beyond them, Suljuk and distant Thond.
Canadius observed that the lands of the known world form a circle, with its center here
at his house and its outer edge passing through the island of Shavulian, far to the west, beyond the old empire.
The edge of the world, muttered the Northman, nodding slowly to himself.
Some arrogance, snorted Glockter, to think of your home as the centre of everything.
Baez looked about him at the vastness of the chamber. The Maker was never short on arrogance, nor were his brothers.
Giselle stared up gormlessly. The room was even higher than it was wide, its ceiling, if there was one, lost in shadow. An iron rail ran round the rough stone walls, a gallery perhaps 20 strides above. Beyond it, higher still, there was another, and another, and another, vague in the half-light. Over all hung the strange device. He gave a sudden start. It was moving. It was all moving. Slowly, smoothly, silently, the rings shifted, turned, revolved one about the other. He could not imagine how it was driven. Somehow, the key turning in the lock must have set it off. Or could it have been turning all these years? He felt dizzy. The whole mechanism now seemed to be spinning, revolving, faster and faster. The galleries, too, shifting in opposite directions. Staring straight upwards was not helping with his sense of disorientation, and he fixed his aching eyes on the floor, on the map of Middleland beneath his feet. He gasped. That was even worse. Now the whole floor seemed to be turning. The entire chamber was revolving around him. The archways leading out were all identical, a dozen of them or more. He could not guess now through which one they had entered. He felt a wave of horrible panic. Only that distant black orb in the center of the device was still. He fixed his watering eyes desperately on that, forcing himself to breathe slow. The feeling faded. The vast hall was still again, almost. The rings were still shifting, almost imperceptibly, inching ever onwards. He swallowed a mouthful of spit, hunched his shoulders, and hurried after the others, with his head down.
"Not that way!"
roared Byers suddenly, his voice exploding in the thick silence, ripping out and bouncing back, echoing 1,000 times around the cavernous space.
"Not that way! Not that way!"
Giselle jumped backwards. The archway and the dim hall beyond looked identical to the one down which the others had been walking, but he saw now that they were off to his right. He had got turned around somehow.
"Go only where I go, I said," hissed the old man.
"Not that way, not that way."
"I'm sorry,"
stammered Giselle, his voice sounding pitifully small in the vast space.
"I thought it all looks the same."
Baez placed a reassuring hand on his shoulder and drew him smoothly away.
"I did not mean to scare you, my friend, but it would be a great shame if one so promising were taken from us quite so young."
Giselle swallowed and stared into the shadowy hallway, wondering what might have awaited him down there. His mind provided any number of unpleasant possibilities. The echoes still whispered at him as he turned away.
"Not that way. Not that way, not that way."
Logan hated this place. The stones were cold and dead. The air was still and dead. Even the sounds they made as they moved fell muffled and lifeless. It wasn't cold and it wasn't hot, and yet his back trickled with sweat, his neck prickled with aimless fear. He'd jerk around every few steps, stung by the sudden feeling he was being watched. But there was never anyone behind him. Only the boy Luthar and the crippled Glockter, looking every bit as worried and confused as he was.
"We chased him through these very halls," murmured Baez quietly. 11 of us, all the Magi together for the last time, all but Kalul. Zacharus and Corneal, they fought with the Maker here, and each was bested. They were fortunate to escape with their lives. And Selmy and Broken Tooth had worse luck. Canadius was the death of them. 2 good friends, 2 brothers, I lost that day.
They edged round a narrow balcony, lit by a pale curtain of light. On one side, sheer stones rose smooth. On the other, they dropped away and were lost in the darkness. A black pit full of shadows, with no far side, no top, no bottom. Despite the vastness of the space, there were no echoes. No air moved. There was not the tiniest breeze. The air was stale and close as a tomb.
"There should be water down there, surely," muttered Glockter, frowning over the rail. "There should be something, shouldn't there?"
He squinted up.
"Where's the ceiling?"
"This place stinks," whined Luther, one hand clasped over his nose. Logan agreed with him for once. It was a smell he knew well, and his lips curled back with hatred at it.
"Smells like fucking flatheads."
"Oh, yes," said Byers. "The Shankar are the Maker's work also."
"His work?"
"Indeed. He took clay and metal and left over flesh, and he made them." Logan stared.
"He made them?"
"To fight in his war. Against us. Against the Magi. Against his brother, Juvens. He bred the first Shankar here and let them loose upon the world, to grow and breed and destroy. That was their purpose. For many years after Canadius's death we hunted them, but we could not catch them all. We drove them into the darkest corners of the world, and there they have grown and bred again, and now come forth to grow and breed and destroy, as they were always meant to do."
Logan gawped at him.
"Shankar." Luther chuckled and shook his head. Flatheads were no laughing matter. Logan turned suddenly, blocking the narrow balcony with his body, looming over Luther in the half-light.
"Something funny?"
"Well, I mean, everyone knows there's no such thing."
"I've fought them with my own hands," growled Logan, "all my life. They killed my wife, my children, my friends. The North is swarming with fucking flatheads."
He leaned down.
"So don't tell me there's no such thing."
Luthar had turned pale. He looked to Glockter for support, but the Inquisitor had sagged against the wall, rubbing at his leg, thin lips tight shut, hollow face beaded with sweat.
"I don't care a shit either way," he snapped.
"There's plenty of Shankar in the world," hissed Logan, sticking his face right up close to Luthar's.
"Maybe one day you'll meet some."
He turned and stalked off after Byers, already disappearing through an archway at the far end of the balcony. He had no wish to be left behind in this place.
Yet another hall.
An enormous one, lined with a silent forest of columns on either side, peopled with a multitude of shadows. Light cut down in shafts from far above, etching strange patterns into the stone floor, shapes of light and dark, lines of black and white.
Almost like writing. Is there a message here? For me?
Glockter was trembling.
If I looked just for a moment longer, perhaps I could understand.
Luthar wandered past. His shadow fell across the floor. The lines were broken. The feeling was gone. Glockter shook himself.
I am losing my reason in this cursed place. I must think clearly. Just the facts, Glockter. Only the facts.
Where does the light come from? He asked. Byers waved his hand.
Above. There are windows?
Perhaps. Glockter's cane tapped into the light, tapped into the dark. His left boot dragged along behind.
Is there nothing but hallway? What's the point of it all?
Who can know the Maker's mind,
intoned Byers pompously, or fathom his great design? He seemed almost to take pride in never giving straight answers. The whole place was a colossal waste of effort as far as Glockter could see.
How many lived here?
Long years ago, in happier times, many hundreds. All manner of people who served Canadius and helped him in his works.
But the Maker was ever distrustful and jealous of his secrets. Bit by bit he turned his followers out into the Agriont, the university. Towards the end, only three lived here. Canadius himself, his assistant, Jeremias, Baez paused for a moment, and his daughter, Ptolemy.
The Maker's daughter?
What of it? Snapped the old man.
Nothing. Nothing at all.
And yet the veneer slipped then, if only for an instant. It is strange that he knows the ways of this place so well.
When did you live here?
Baez frowned deep. There is such a thing as too many questions. Glockter watched him walk away.
Salt was wrong. The Archlector, fallible after all. He underestimated this Baez, and it cost him. Who is this bald, irritable fool who can make a sprawling idiot of the most powerful man in the Union?
Standing here, deep within the bowels of this unearthly place, the answer did not seem so strange.
The first of the Magi.
This is it.
What?
Asked Logan. The hallway stretched out in either direction, curving gently, disappearing into the darkness, walls of huge stone blocks, unbroken on either side. Baez did not answer. He was running his hands gently over the stones, looking for something.
Yes, this is it.
Baez pulled the key out from his shirt. You might want to prepare yourselves.
For what?
The Magus slid the key into an unseen hole. One of the blocks that made up the walls suddenly vanished, flying up into the ceiling with a thunderous crash. Logan reeled, shaking his head. He saw Luthar bent forward, hands clamped over his ears. The whole corridor seemed to hum with crashing echoes, on and on.
Wait,
said Baez, though Logan could barely hear him over the ringing in his head.
Touch nothing, go nowhere.
He stepped through the opening, leaving the key lodged in the wall. Logan peered after him. A glimmer of light shone down a narrow passageway. A rushing sound washed through like the trickling of a stream. Logan felt a strange curiosity picking at him. He glanced back at the other two.
Perhaps Baez had meant only for them to stay.
He ducked through the doorway and squinted up at a bright, round chamber. Light flooded in from high above, piercing light, almost painful to look at after the gloom of all the rest. The curving walls were perfect, clean white stone, running with trickling water, flowing down all around and collecting in a round pool below. The air was cool, damp on Logan's skin. A narrow bridge sprang out from the passage, steps leading upwards, ending at a tall white pillar rising from the water. Baez was standing there on top of it, staring down at something. Logan crept up behind the Magus, breathing shallow. A block of white stone stood there. Water dripped onto its smooth, hard center from above. A regular tap, 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 always in the same spot. Two things lay in the thin layer of wet. The first was a square box, simply made from dark metal, big enough to hold a man's head, maybe. The other was altogether stranger. A weapon, perhaps, like an axe. A long shaft made from tiny metal tubes, all twisted about each other like the stems of old vines. At one end there was a scored grip. At the other there was a flat piece of metal, pierced with small holes, a long, thin hook curving out from it. The light played over its many dark surfaces, glittering with beads of moisture. Strange, beautiful, fascinating. On the grip, one letter glinted, silver in the dark metal. Logan recognized it from his sword. The mark of Canadius. The work of the Master Maker.
What is this? He asked, reaching out for it.
Don't touch it! Screamed Baez, slapping Logan's hand away. Did I not tell you to wait?
Logan took an uncertain step back. He had never seen the Magus look so worried, but he couldn't keep his eyes off the strange thing on the slab.
Is it a weapon?
Baez breathed a long, slow breath.
A most terrible one, my friend. A weapon against which no steel, no stone, no magic can protect you. Do not even tread near it, I warn you. There are dangers.
The Divider, Canadius called it, and with it he killed his brother Juvens, my master. He once told me it has two edges, one here, one on the other side.
What the hell does that mean?
Muttered Logan. He couldn't even see one edge you could cut with. Baez shrugged.
If I knew that, I suppose that I'd be the master maker instead of merely the first of the magi.
He reached forward and lifted the box, wincing as though it was a great weight.
Could you help me with this?
Logan hooked his hands under it and gasped. It could hardly have weighed more if it was a block of solid iron.
Heavy, he grunted. Canadius forged it to be strong as all his great skill could make it, not to keep its contents safe from the world.
He leaned close and spoke softly.
To keep the world safe from its contents.
Logan frowned down.
What's in it?
Nothing,
muttered Baez.
Yet.
Giselle was trying to think of three men in the world he hated more. Brint? He was simply a swollen-headed idiot. Gorst? He had merely done his meager best to beat Giselle in a fencing match. Varouz? He was just a pompous old ass. Nope, these three were at the top of his list. The arrogant old man with his idiotic prattle and his self-important air of mystery. The hulking savage, with his ugly scars and his menacing frown. The patronizing cripple, with his smug little comments and his pretensions of knowing all about life. The three of them, combined with the stagnant air and perpetual gloom of this horrible place, were almost enough to make Giselle puke again. The only thing he could imagine worse than his present company was no company at all. He looked into the shadows all around and shuddered at the thought. Still, his spirits rose as they turned a corner. There was a small square of daylight up ahead. He hurried towards it, overtaking Glockter as he shambled along on his cane, mouth watering with anticipation at the thought of being back out under the sky. Giselle closed his eyes with pleasure as he stepped into the open air. The cold wind stroked his face, and he gasped in great lungfuls of it. The relief was terrific, as though he had been trapped down there in the darkness for weeks, as though fingers clamped around his throat had just now been released. He walked forward across a wide open space, paved with stark, flat stones. Nine Fingers and Baez stood side by side up ahead, behind a parapet, waist high, and beyond them, the Agriont came into view below. A patchwork of white walls, grey roofs, glinting windows, green gardens. They were nowhere near the summit of the Maker's House, only on one of the lowest roofs above the gate, but still terrifyingly high. Giselle recognized the crumbling university, the shining dome of the Lord's Round, the squat mass of the House of Questions. He could see the square of marshals, a bowl of wooden seating in amongst the buildings, perhaps even the tiny yellow flash of the fencing circle in its center. Beyond the citadel, surrounded by its white wall and twinkling moat, the city was a sprawling gray mass under the dirty gray sky, stretching all the way to the sea. Giselle laughed with disbelief and delight. The Tower of Chains was a stepladder compared to this. He was so high above the world that all seemed somehow still, frozen in time. He felt like a king. No man had seen this, not for hundreds of years. He was huge, grand, far more important than the tiny people that must live and work in the little buildings down there. He turned to look at Glockter, but the cripple was not smiling. He was even paler than ever, frowning at the toy city, his left eye twitching with worry.
"Scared of heights?" laughed Giselle. Glockter turned his ashen face toward him.
"There were no steps. We climbed no steps to get here."
Giselle's grin began to fade.
"No steps. Do you understand? How could it be? How? Tell me that."
Giselle swallowed as he thought over the way they had come. The cripple was right. No steps, no ramps. They had gone neither up nor down. Yet here they were, far above the tallest tower of the Agriont. He felt sick again. The view now seemed dizzying, disgusting, obscene. He backed unsteadily away from the parapet. He wanted to go home.
I followed him through the darkness alone, and here I faced him, Canadius, the Master Maker. Here we fought. Fire and steel and flesh. Here we stood. He threw Ptolemy from the roof before my eyes. I saw it happen, but I could not stop him. His own daughter. Can you imagine? No one could have deserved that less than she. There never was a more innocent spirit.
Logan frowned. He hardly knew what to say to this.
Here we struggled,
muttered Baez, his meaty fists clenched tight on the bare parapet.
I tore at him with fire and steel and flesh, and he at me. I cast him down. He fell burning and broke upon the bridge below. And so the last of the sons of Eos passed from the world, so many of their secrets lost forever. They destroyed each other, all four of them. What a waste.
Baez turned to look at Logan.
But that was a long time ago, eh, my friend? Long ago.
He puffed out his cheeks and hunched his shoulders.
Let us leave this place. It feels like a tomb. It is a tomb. Let us seal it up once more, and the memories with it. That is all in the past.
Ah, said Logan. My father used to say the seeds of the past bear fruit in the present.
So they do.
Baez reached out slowly, and his fingers brushed against the cold, dark metal of the box in Logan's hands.
So they do. Your father was a wise man.
Glockter's leg was burning. His twisted spine was a river of fire from his arse to his skull. His mouth was dry as sawdust, his face sweaty and twitching, the breath hissing in his nose, but he pressed on through the darkness, away from the vast hall with its black orb and its strange contraption, on towards the open door,
and into the light.
He stood there with his head tipped back on the narrow bridge before the narrow gateway, his hand trembling on the handle of his cane, blinking and rubbing his eyes, gasping in the free air and feeling the cool breeze on his face.
Who would have thought that wind can feel so fine? Maybe it's just as well there weren't any steps. I might never have made it out.
Luthar was already halfway back across the bridge, hurrying as though he had a devil astride behind. Nine Fingers was not far away, breathing hard and muttering something in Northern over and over. Still alive, Glockter thought it might be. His big hands were clenched tight around that square metal box, tendons standing out as though it weighed as much as an anvil.
There was more to this trip than just proving a point. What is it that they brought out from there? What weighs so heavily?
He glanced back into the darkness and shivered.
He was not sure he even wanted to know.
Baez strolled out of the tunnel and into the open air, looking smug as ever.
"So, Inquisitor," he said breezily, "how did you find your trip into the House of the Maker?" "A twisted, strange, and horrible nightmare. I might even have preferred to return to the Emperor's prisons for a few hours."
"Something to do of a morning," he snapped.
I'm so glad you found it diverting, chuckled Baez as he pulled the rod of dark metal out from his shirt. And tell me, do you still believe that I'm a liar? Or have your suspicions finally been laid to rest? Glockter frowned at the key. He frowned at the old man. He frowned into the crushing darkness of the Maker's house. My suspicions grow with every passing moment. They are never laid to rest. They only change shape. Honestly, I don't know what to believe. Good. Knowing your own ignorance is the first step to enlightenment. Between you and me, though, I'd think of something else to tell the Archlector. Glockter felt his eyelid flickering. You'd better start across, eh, Inquisitor, while I lock up? The plunge to the cold water below no longer seemed to hold much fear. If I were to fall, at least I would die in the light. Glockter looked back only once, as he heard the doors of the Maker's house shut with a soft click, the circles slide back into place. All as it was before we arrived. He turned his prickling back, sucked his gums against the familiar waves of nausea, and cursed and struggled his limping way across the bridge. Lothar was hammering desperately on the old gates at the far end. "Let us in!" He was nearly sobbing as Glockter hobbled up, an edge of cracked panic to his voice. "Let us in!" The door finally wobbled open to reveal a shocked-looking warden. Such a shame. I was sure that Captain Luthar was about to burst into tears. The proud winner of the contest, the Union's bravest young son, the very flower of manhood, blubbing on his knees. That sight could almost have made the trip worthwhile. Luthar darted through the open gate, and Ninefingers followed grimly after, cradling the metal box in his arms. The warden squinted at Glockter as he limped up to the gate. "Back so soon?" "You old dolt. What the hell are you talking about, so soon?" "I'm only halfway through my eggs. You've been gone less than half an hour." Glockter barked a joyless laugh. "Half a day, perhaps." But he frowned as he peered past into the courtyard. The shadows were almost exactly where they had been when they left. Early morning still? But how? "The Maker once told me that time is all in the mind." Glockter winced as he turned his head. Baez had come up behind him and was tapping the side of his bald skull with a thick finger. "It could be worse, believe me. It's when you come out before you went in that you really start to worry." He smiled, eyes glinting in the light through the doorway. "Playing the fool or trying to make a fool of me? Either way, these games grow tiresome." "Enough riddles," sneered Glockter. "Why not just tell me what you're after?" The first of the Magi, if such he was, grinned still wider. "I like you, Inquisitor, I really do. I wouldn't be surprised if you were the only honest man left in this whole damn country. We should have a talk at some point, you and I. A talk about what I want and about what you want." His smile vanished. "But not today." And he stepped through the open door, leaving Glockter behind in the shadows. Chapter 39 Nobody's Dog. "Why me?" West murmured to himself through gritted teeth, staring across the bridge towards the south gate. That nonsense at the docks had taken him longer than expected, much longer. But then, didn't everything these days? It sometimes felt as if he was the only man in the Union seriously preparing for a war, and had to organize the entire business on his own, right down to counting the nails that would hold the horse's shoes on. He was already late for his daily meeting with Marshal Burr, and knew there would be 100 impossible things for him to get done today. There always were. To become involved in some pointless hold-up here at the very gate of the Agriont was all he needed. "Why the hell must it be me?" His head was starting to hurt again. that all-too-familiar pulsing behind the eyes. Each day it seemed to come on earlier and end up worse. Because of the heat over the last few days, the guards had been permitted to come to duty without full armor. West reckoned that at least two of them were now regretting it. One was folded up on the ground near the gate, hands clasped between his legs, whimpering noisily. His sergeant stood stooped over next to him, blood running from his nose and pattering dark red drops on the stones of the bridge. The two other soldiers in the detail had their spears lowered, blades pointing towards a scrawny, dark-skinned youth. Another southerner stood nearby, an old man with long grey hair, leaning against the handrail and watching the scene with an expression of profound resignation. The youth glanced quickly over his shoulder, and West felt a sting of surprise. A woman. Black hair hacked off short and sticking off her head in a mess of greasy spikes. One sleeve was torn off round her shoulder, and a long, sinewy brown arm stuck out, ending in a fist bunched tight around the grip of a curved knife. The blade shone, mirror bright and evilly sharp, the one and only thing about her that looked clean. There was a thin grey scar all the way down the right side of her face, through her black eyebrow and across her scowling lips. It was her eyes, though, which truly caught West off guard. Slightly slanted, narrowed with the deepest hostility and suspicion, and yellow. He had seen all kinds of cantics in his time, while he was fighting in Gurkul in the war, but he never saw eyes like that before. Deep, rich, golden yellow. Like piss. That was the smell as he came closer. Piss and dirt and a lot of old, sour sweat. He remembered that from the war, all right. The stink of men who had not washed in a very long time. West fought the compulsion to wrinkle up his nose and breathe through his mouth as he approached, and the urge to circle out wide and keep his distance from that glittering blade. You have to show no fear if you're to calm a dangerous situation, however much you might be feeling. In his experience, if you could seem to be in control, you were more than halfway to being there. "What the hell is going on here?" he growled at the bloody-faced sergeant. He had no need at all to feign annoyance. He was getting later and angrier by the second. "These stinking beggars wanted to come into the Agriant, sir. I tried to turn them away, of course, but they have letters." "Letters?" The strange old man tapped West on the shoulder, handed over a folded sheet of paper, slightly grubby round the edges. He read it, his frown growing steadily deeper. "This is a letter of transit signed by Lord Hoff himself. They must be admitted." "But not armed, sir. I said they couldn't go in armed." The sergeant held up an odd-looking bow of dark wood in one hand and a curved sword of the Gurkish design in the other. "It was enough of a struggle getting her to give these up, but when I tried to search her, this Gurkish bitch..." The woman hissed and took a quick step forward, and the sergeant and his two guards shuffled nervously back in a tight group.
"Peace, Pharaoh," sighed the old man in the Cantic tongue. "For God's sake, peace."
The woman spat on the stones of the bridge and hissed some curse that West could not understand, weaving the blade back and forth in a way that suggested she knew how to use it and was more than willing.
"Why me?" West mumbled under his breath.
It was plain he was going nowhere until this difficulty was resolved. As if he didn't have enough to worry about. He took a deep breath and did his best to put himself in the position of the stinking woman. A stranger, surrounded by strange-looking people, speaking words she didn't understand, brandishing spears and trying to search her. Probably she was even now thinking about how horrible West smelled. Disorientated and afraid, most likely, rather than dangerous. She did look very dangerous, though, and not in the least afraid. The old man certainly seemed the more reasonable of the two, so West turned to him first. "Are you two from Gurkul?" he asked him in broken Cantic. The old man turned his tired eyes on West.
"No, there is more to the south than the Gurkish."
"Gadir, then? Taurish?
You know the South?
A little. I fought there in the war. The old man jerked his head at the woman, watching them suspiciously with her slanted yellow eyes.
She is from a place called Muntaz.
I never heard of it.
Why would you have?
The old man shrugged his bony shoulders.
A small country by the sea, far to the east of Shafa, beyond the mountains. The Gurkish conquered it years ago, and its people were scattered or made slaves. Apparently, she has been in a foul mood ever since.
The woman scowled over at them, keeping one eye on the soldiers. And you?
Oh, I come from much further south, beyond Kanta, beyond the desert, even beyond the circle of the world. The land of my birth will not be on your maps, friend. Yulwe is my name.
He held out a long black hand. Column West. The woman watched them warily as they shook hands.
This one is called West, Pharaoh. He fought against the Gurkish. Will that make you trust him?
Yulwe didn't sound very hopeful, and indeed the woman's shoulders were still as hunched and bristling as ever, her grip on the knife no less tight. One of the soldiers chose that unfortunate moment to take a step forward, jabbing at the air with his spear, and the woman snarled and spat again, shouting more unintelligible curses.
That's enough!
West heard himself roaring at the guard.
Put your fucking spears up!
They blinked at him, shocked, and he fought to bring his voice back under control.
I don't think this is a full-scale invasion, do you? Put them up!
Reluctantly, the spear points drifted away from the woman. West stepped firmly towards her, keeping his eyes fixed on hers with all the authority he could muster. Show no fear, he thought to himself, but his heart was thumping. He held out his open palm, almost close enough to touch her.
The knife, said West sharply in his bad cantic. Please, you will not be harmed, you have my word.
The woman stared at him with those slanted, beady yellow eyes, then at the guards with the spears, then back to him. She took plenty of time over it. West stood there, mouth dry, head still thumping, getting later and later, sweating under his uniform in the hot sun, trying to ignore the woman's smell. Time passed.
God's teeth, Pharaoh! Snapped the old man suddenly. I am old. Take pity on me. I may only have a few years left. Give the man the knife before I die.
Psst! She hissed, curling her lip. For a dizzy, stretched-out moment, the knife went up, then the hilt slapped down into West's palm. He allowed himself a dry swallow of relief. Right up until the last moment, he had been almost sure she would give him the sharp end.
Thank you,
he said, a deal more calmly than he felt. He handed the knife to the sergeant.
Stow the weapons away and escort our guests into the Agriont, and if any harm comes to anyone, especially her, I'll be holding you responsible. Understand?
He glowered at the sergeant for a moment, then stepped through the gate into the tunnel before anything else could go wrong, leaving the old man and the stinking woman behind him. His head was thumping harder even than before. Damn it, he was late.
Why the hell me? He grumbled to himself. I'm afraid the armories are closed for the day, sneered Major Valamir, staring down his nose at West as though at a beggar whining for small change. Our quotas are fulfilled ahead of schedule, and we will not be lighting the forges again this week. Perhaps if you had arrived on time.
The pounding in West's head was growing worse than ever. He forced himself to breathe slowly and keep his voice calm and even. There was nothing to be gained by losing his temper. There was never anything to be gained by that.
I understand, Major, said West patiently, but there is a war on. Many of the levies we have received are scarcely armed, and Lord Marshal Burr has asked that the forges be lit in order to provide equipment for them.
This was not entirely true, but since joining the Marshal's staff, West had more or less given up on telling the whole truth to anyone.
That was no way to get anything done. He now employed a mixture of wheedling, bluster, and outright lies, humble entreaties and veiled threats, and had become quite expert at judging which tactic would be most effective on what man. Unfortunately, he had yet to strike the right chord with Major Valamir, the master of the king's armories. Somehow, their being equal in rank made matters all the more difficult. He could not quite get away with bullying the man, but could not quite bring himself to beg. Furthermore, in terms of social standing, they were anything but equals. Valamir was old nobility, from a powerful family and arrogant beyond belief. He made Jezal Dan Luthar seem a humble, selfless type, and his total lack of experience in the field only made matters worse. He behaved doubly like an ass in order to compensate. Instructions from West, though they might come from Marshal Burr himself, were as welcome as they would have been from a reeking swineherd. Today was no exception.
"This month's quotas are fulfilled, Major West!"
Valamir managed to put a sneering emphasis into the name.
"And so the forges are closed, that is all."
"And this is what you would have me tell the Lord Marshal?"
"The arming of levies is the responsibility of those lords that provide them," he recited primly. "I cannot be blamed if they fall short on their obligations. It is simply not our problem, Major West, and you may tell that to the Lord Marshal."
This was always the way of it, back and forth, from Burr's offices to the various commissary departments, to the commanders of companies, of battalions, of regiments, to the stores scattered around the Agriont and the city, to the armories, the barracks, the stables, to the docks where the soldiers and their equipment would begin to embark in just a few short days, to other departments, and back to where he began, with miles walked and nothing done. Each night he would drop into bed like a stone, only to start up a few hours later with it all to do again. As commander of a battalion, his trade had been to fight the enemy with steel. As a staff officer, it seemed, his role was to fight his own side with paper, more secretary than soldier. He felt like a man trying to push a huge stone up a hill, straining and straining, getting nowhere, but unable to stop pushing, in case the rock should fall and crush him. Meanwhile, arrogant bastards who were in just the same danger lazed on the slopes beside him, saying, "Well, it's not my rock." He understood now why during the war in Gurkul there had sometimes not been enough food for the men to eat, or clothes for them to wear, or wagons to draw the supplies with, or horses to draw the wagons, or all manner of other things that were deeply necessary and easily anticipated. West would be damned before that happened because of some oversight of his, and he would certainly be damned if he would see men die for want of a weapon to fight with. He tried yet again to calm himself, but each time his head hurt more, and his voice was cracking with the effort.
"And what if we find ourselves mired in Angland with a crowd of half-clothed, unarmed peasants to provide for? What then, Major Valamir? Whose problem will it be? Not yours, I dare say. You'll still be here with your cold forges for company."
West knew as soon as he said it that he had gone too far. The man positively bristled.
"How dare you, sir? Are you questioning my personal honour? My family goes back 9 generations in the king's own."
West rubbed his eyes, not knowing whether he wanted to laugh or cry.
"I have no doubts as to your courage, I assure you. That was not my meaning at all."
He tried to put himself in Valamir's position. He did not really know the pressures the man was under. Probably he would rather be in command of soldiers than smiths. Probably. It was no use. The man was a shit and West hated him.
"This is not a question of your honour, Major, or that of your family. This is a question of our being fit for war."
Valamir's eyes had turned deadly cold.
"Just who do you think you're talking to, you dirty commoner? All the influence you have you owe to Burr, and who is he but an oaf from the provinces, risen to his rank by fortune alone?"
West blinked. He guessed what they said about him behind his back, of course, but it was another thing to hear it to his face.
"And when Burr is gone, what will become of you, eh? Where will you be without him to hide behind? You've no blood, no family."
Valamir's lips twisted in a cold sneer.
"Apart from that sister of yours, of course, and from what I hear..."
West found himself moving forward fast.
"What?" he snarled. "What was that?"
His expression must have been dire indeed. He saw the color draining from Valamir's face.
You think I need Burr to fight my battles, you fucking gutless worm?"
Before he knew it, he had moved again, and Valamir stumbled back towards the wall, flinching sideways and raising one arm as if to ward off an expected blow. It was the most West could do to stop his hands from grabbing hold of the little bastard and shaking him until his head came off. His own skull was throbbing, pounding. He felt as though the pressure would pop his eyes right out of his head. He dragged in long, slow breaths through his nose, clenched his fists until they hurt. The anger slowly subsided, back below the point where it threatened to take sudden control of his body. It only pulsed now, squeezing at his chest.
"If you have something to say on the subject of my sister," he whispered softly, "then you can say it. Say it now."
He let his left hand drop slowly to sit on the hilt of his sword.
"And we can settle this outside the city walls."
Major Valamir shrank back still further.
"I heard nothing," he whispered. "Nothing at all." "Nothing at all."
West looked down into his white face for a moment longer, then stepped away.
"Now, if you would be so good as to reopen the forges for me, we have a great deal of work to get through."
Valamir blinked for a moment.
"Of course, I will have them lit at once."
West turned on his heel and stalked off, knowing the man was glowering daggers at his back, knowing that he had made yet another bad situation worse. One more highborn enemy among the many. The really galling thing was that the man was right. Without Burr, he was as good as finished. He had no family, apart from that sister of his.
Damn it, his head hurt. "Why me?" he hissed to himself. "Why?"
There was still a lot to do today, enough for a whole day's work on its own, but West could take no more. His head hurt so badly that he could hardly see. He had to lie down in the dark, with a wet cloth over his face, if only for an hour, if only for a minute. He fumbled in his pocket for his key, his other hand clamped over his aching eyes, his teeth locked together. Then he heard a sound on the other side of the door, a faint clink of glass.
"Ardy." "Now," he hissed to himself.
Not now. Why the hell had he ever given her a key? Cursing softly, he raised his fist to knock. Knocking on his own door, that was where he was now. His fist never made it to the wood. A most unpleasant image began to form in the back of his mind. Ardy and Luther, naked and sweaty, writhing around on his carpet. He turned his key swiftly in the lock and shoved the door open. She was standing by the window, alone, and, he was relieved to see, fully dressed. He was less pleased to see her filling a glass right to the brim from the decanter, though. She raised an eyebrow at him as he burst through the door.
"Oh, it's you."
"Who the hell else would it be?" snapped West. "These are my rooms, aren't they?"
"Somebody's not in the best of moods this morning."
A bit of wine slopped over the rim of her glass and onto the table. She wiped it up with her hand and sucked her fingers, then took a long swig from the glass for good measure. Her every movement niggled at him. West grimaced and shoved the door shut.
"Do you have to drink so much?"
"I understand that a young lady should have a beneficial pastime." Her words were careless, as usual, but even through his headache West could tell there was something strange going on.
She kept glancing towards the desk, then she was moving towards it. He got there first, snatched up a piece of paper from the top, one line written on it.
"What's this?"
"Nothing. Give it me."
He held her away with one arm and read it. "The usual place, tomorrow night, A." West's skin prickled with horror.
"Nothing? Nothing?"